All right, how's everybody doing today? Good? End of the day, APHA? Seen some good talks? Anyone go to Dr. Kamara Jones' talk at all? No one in the room? All right, I went. It's truly inspiring. You can go see her. I'm plugging her, and she does not know it. But I'm here today to talk about a project. It's NIH-funded through an R21 mechanism. The title is Improving Food Allergy Management Through an Electronic Precision Support Tool. I have no relationships to disclose. And to provide a little bit of background, how many in here know a little bit about food allergy? A lot about food allergy. All right, how many in the room are clinicians? No? Public health enthusiasts? Yeah, okay, systems people. All right, so my team conducted a prevalence study a couple of years ago that estimated that 8% of US children have a food allergy. So what that means is about 1 in 13 or 2 in every classroom are affected today. And we have other research supporting that this is increasing. Of those 40,000 that we surveyed, we saw that upwards of 40% had actually experienced a severe reaction. Severe reactions such as anaphylaxis, which can be life-threatening. So what does this mean in terms of primary care? What we learned from some previous research is that even if children are referred to an allergist, which is a part of the guidelines we'll speak to in a little bit, the average wait time was 4 months. As a part of that study, what was particularly troubling and puzzling is that was a group of privately insured children. So 4 months wait time from we think you have a food allergy to seeing an allergist. And what I think is particularly important is that oftentimes a lot of children don't even get to the allergist to receive care, and that pediatric clinicians are often the first and sometimes only providers children can access. So obviously there's a knowledge gap. What's going on? We know that physicians themselves recognize that they have misconceptions regarding food allergies. A lot of them are aware of the most common food allergens, what we call the top eight. How many of you know the most common allergens? What are they? Yell them out. Egg, peanuts, tree nuts, soy. My team's not allowed to participate. Yeah, you guys can know them, but what we did is we surveyed clinicians and primary care clinicians specifically, and a lot of people couldn't actually identify the top eight. What's even a little more puzzling is that a lot of clinicians themselves said they didn't feel comfortable instructing families in the appropriate administration of epinephrine. So we have food allergies. Right now we know there aren't any really viable treatments to market yet. We have some treatments that are being studied, such as oral immunotherapy, sublingual immunotherapy, but really this is about prevention, right? Prevention in terms of people not coming into contact with their allergen, but also in terms of preparedness, making sure that people have their prescriptions of epinephrine, which is if they're having a life-threatening or a serious reaction, they need to use, and making sure they know how to use it. So physicians themselves are saying, I don't feel comfortable training families on how to use epinephrine. So as we know, we have a lot of great clinical guidelines, and in 2010, the NIAID actually came out with guidelines for the management of food allergy, because we didn't know a lot then. One thing that's also troubling about guidelines, as you can see, they distilled food allergy management into 43 concise clinical recommendations. And as you know, I don't know, no pediatricians in the room? But we all respect pediatricians because they're super busy and they're dealing with a lot of issues, right? So distilling down food allergy into 43 clinical recommendations isn't all that helpful. We wanted them to be helpful, and we also wanted to better understand how pediatricians could help manage allergies, especially if it's taking upwards of 4 months to get these kiddos to an allergist. So our study goal was to develop and evaluate the feasibility and acceptability of electronic clinician decision support tool to improve the diagnosis and management of food allergy in the primary care setting. We really were looking at the chronic care model when we were trying to think through this, and really decided to focus on health systems and decision support. Here's a little bit of a process overview of our study. We had three aims. As you can see, the first aim was the FAST development, which is the food allergy support tool. And here we were really trying to kind of create a prototype and appropriate education materials for families. And then what we did is we took it to three clinics. where we went through a rapid cycle process improvement and feasibility assessment. So what we did is we had a training, I'll talk about this a little bit later, and then we followed up several times with surveys to see what was working, what wasn't working, and change the tool and keep going and iterating until we had one that finally worked. And we're still in AIM 3. We did some pre-post chart reviews, which I'll discuss in a little bit. So we've done the pre, we knew where all of our clinics started and our clinicians and how they were doing. And in a couple of months we'll be doing our posts as well. I mean, overall, here's kind of the technical architecture. You guys all know you're here for health IT. We're really trying to connect, you know, the clinicians with the support they need and the training and the information they need, but also try to bring in families because they're a big part of managing food allergy. So what we did is we convened an expert panel of health services researchers, pediatricians, allergists, and clinical informatics consultants. We reviewed the NIAID guidelines extensively, but we also talked to folks about what were they currently doing, right? A lot of people obviously weren't using the guidelines or weren't able to truly integrate them into practice at this time. And then we really wanted to develop a simplified decision model for clinicians. So here's a little bit more about our chart reviews. We reviewed medical records of children age 0 to 18. That were obtained from 3 urban primary care pediatric practices here in Chicago. The patients were included if they had an encounter between 2012 and 2015 containing an ICD-9 code for an initial food allergy diagnosis. And records were analyzed to describe provider adherence to the NIAID guidelines. So here's a little bit about baseline with our practices. We had 123 patients. They were on the young side, had a mean age of 4 years, and were most commonly allergic to egg and tree nut, which you guys all knew about. The clinical reaction history was documented in 99% of encounters, which is actually pretty high. In terms of IgE, which is the test that's ordered to help confirm a diagnosis, that was only ordered in 24% of patients. The epinephrine prescriptions was documented for 67% of patients, so still have a ways to go on that. And the emergency action plans, which, are people familiar with emergency action plans? Yep, okay. Was only documented in 24% of encounters. Caregiver counseling was documented 70% of the time, so, and the referral to an allergist only occurred or was documented in 68% of cases. So what we did is, you've seen a little bit of this already, is we tried to distill those 43 concepts down into 5 steps, something that would make sense for pediatricians or nurse practitioners working in the pediatric setting, something that they feel like they could do or at least help be a part of the plan. And so we defined adherence to NIAID guidelines if you documented clinical history, if you ordered or if eventually the allergist ordered allergen-specific IgEs, if you actually prescribed the epinephrine auto-injector, if you documented counseling, and if you did refer to an allergist. And we developed our clinical decision support tool. So this is a little bit of an overview of the FAST tool itself, which include a flow sheet, dot phrases, smart set, and best practice alerts. So this is what we considered our full decision support. Here's a little bit of a screenshot of a best practice alert. Like they put in symptoms or trigger words. This would often come up if they were gonna start going through the clinical decision support tool. And here's a little bit of how the screen would look. You see food allergy symptoms, severe or mild. You see the opportunity to talk through management strategies, what medications were given, so we can better understand how these families were reacting. And then you see kind of down at the bottom if they were going to order IgE tests or if they're referring to an allergist. So kind of getting back to those 5 steps. I think one thing that we tried to do was to make this interesting. I know we all face a lot of resistance and barriers, especially working in primary care, because there's so much to do and how to make this fun and interesting. So our team actually, have you guys seen this music video in England that they used for asthma? No? So this guy, we got a harebrained idea. This guy in London actually created a music video to the tune of Breakfast at Tiffany's. I would encourage you to look it up, but it really talked about asthma management guidelines at a hospital, and he used it as an intervention, and it actually improved guideline adherence, and so we thought, why not us? So little did I know with getting an MPH that I would be charged with helping to create a music video, but we decided to do that. I'm not going to show it today, but I would encourage you to Google it. It's on YouTube. It's called I Will Thrive, sung to the tune of I Will Survive. And it was my boss and our team really talking, or rather singing, through the NIAID guidelines as a tool to help clinicians get excited and want to kind of hang out with us for a long time as we are iterating through the development of the clinical decision support tool process. I mean, obviously, that was just a part of the initial training. And what we found was people are in different places at different times. So we also created kind of one-on-one coaching for training and using the tool to try and get people to use it. We also had a series of rapid cycle surveys, which I'll go through some examples of the outcomes from those surveys. So here was the questionnaire. It was pretty short. We emailed this out to them. Did you use the FAST and did it prove quicker than your typical workflow, right? Because one of the problems with clinical decision support is that it actually, what? Does it make it quicker? Slows you down. I mean, how many times do we hear that? How many clicks do you have to go through, etc.? So if we were going to say that this was going to work, we really wanted to make sure that it was helping people with their workflow. We also asked if the tool had improved their ability to kind of go through those five steps that I outlined before. And then we just asked for general recommendations. And then you'll see at the bottom, we had some open-ended questions to ask people to define barriers, why they weren't using the tool if they weren't using it, and any other suggestions that we could take back to our clinical informatics folks to try and change the tool, update it, and streamline it. So not surprisingly, I'm sure for all of you who work in this world, I put up a couple of problems that came up that we generally saw across the board. For one clinician problem, it was, I think we just may need more training, but once I used the tool, then I could not get out and it asked me to do more detail than I had time to, so it actually took me longer, right? So that's a big problem for us when we're trying to integrate it. We want to make sure that people are actually trained. So in the short term, we reached out, set up more one-on-one training in their busy lives, which was great. But in the long term, I think what this has really forced us to do is to think about how the tool is even designed. So before we move on to the next study, we've already started talking with some folks up at the design school at Northwestern to really think through not only the importance of how you would, you know, manage food allergy, but kind of taking some of those human-centered design aspects to the tool itself to try and streamline it further. Another kind of clinician problem was they didn't have enough time to do everything we were asking, right? Counseling is still pretty extensive. Actually filling out an action plan, which is kind of two sides, takes a long time. So that was a little glitchy, you'll see from the comment up there. But then there were some kind of longer term ideas about creating an app where families could actually engage in their care before coming. If they were, you know, diagnosed with a food allergy, they could potentially engage in an app through our FAST tool to fill out part of the food allergy action plan ahead of time. So in conclusion, as we all know, adherence to best practice guidelines varies, and we know that it varies between specific recommendations. We found that a lot of it was happening at the clinic level, what people had kind of gotten used to implementing and how the practice kind of worked in general in terms of workflows. One of the big issues that came up was a lot of our pediatricians really weren't sure if some of those five guidelines were actually a part of their role, right? So a lot of times, pediatricians won't be ordering specific IgEs, but our thought process was we want to make sure at least they're getting to an allergist then. So if they're not ordering the test, are they referring to an allergist, and what does that look like? When implementing a CDS, we also must take into account the different types of innovation factors, which I'm sure you all know about. I sat in the room many times with folks that had their way of charting and were not going to diverge. And And although frustrating, it kind of helped us sort through, can we distill this down further? Or what aspects of this, such as the emergency action plan and getting that epinephrine auto-injector, could we make really easy through dot phrases? So if someone doesn't want to click through the whole tool, they can at least have those important items. And then there are always workflow considerations. So not only clinician behavior, but I would say clinic behavior in terms of how patients are actually coming in, who's a part of the intake process. So I think one of our lessons learned is we may need to incorporate more for MAs or people who are actually rooming patients as a part of the tool. We didn't get to test that as much this time. I mean, our next steps are really to do those post-chart reviews to see if we were able to improve guideline adherence, and hopefully we were. This, I don't know if people are familiar with the R21 mechanism, but it was really a developmental amount of funding to see if we could get a tool to work, but I think then after that, we want to try and do a future randomized control trial in clinics and potentially also target residency training programs. Not surprisingly, kind of at the last minute, we added a couple of residency clinics to our IRB to see what would happen, and of course, they adopt very differently, and CDS tools are a little bit more part of their life, so one of our strategies might be to target those programs as well. So here's my whole team. It's a lot of people working on this, and to get you excited about the video, here is my team dressed up as food allergens. I am the green bean right in the middle. But thank you, and please let me know if you have any questions.
So do you have any questions for Ashley, or we can even take questions for the first speaker also at this time?
I will be clear. I am an MPH all the way. I don't actually develop the tools, but we have really great access to our clinical informatics team at Murray Children's Hospital. So that long list, there were two people, Agata and Margie, who were really on our team and part of our panel that would then kind of help build out our design.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And how long
I would say we, over the course of a year, we met pretty strategically with our clinical champions as well as our informatics folks and went through that process. And then to get to the rapid cycle, I should correct myself. The tool wasn't completed until the end of the rapid cycle. So then another kind of 6 to 8 months, depending on how many times we needed to go back to assess how people were using.
I couldn't hear you well, but adherence to guidelines was the goal, and we saw increase for all of the adherence measures. We had the opioid agreement and the functional assessment status, so the patient had to have a visit every 3 months to have their pain reassessed if they were on chronic opioids. And another thing, the urine drug testing, they went up. Everything went up, and we saw really an improvement in the provider's behavior, prescribing behaviors, and monitoring behaviors. So we still are using the same clinical dashboard, and as next steps, we will implement the daily dose morphine equivalency to kind of touch more on the patient's safety. And then we already actually improved the clinical dashboard with data from the Connecticut PMP. It's a work in progress, really, but providers are using it and teams are using the dashboards to plan their care. For example, during the morning huddles, they review the dashboard to see who's coming for a visit and if they are due for something like UDT or opioid agreement, the providers is assigning the specific tasks to their team to obtain this information or to do the lab test. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.